Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Eve Wittenberg, Senior Research Scientist at the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard School of Public Health, about family caregivers. I know this is something that is near and dear to all of us as we look after our family members, and has been, you know, important to you recently as we're all exploring having aging parents.
Yeah, you know, it's a blessing to be able to give back to our parents and be able to care for them, but having siblings all around the country and figuring out how to do this well and the time and being able to go but yet also work. These are the complexities we're all dealing with. Even you, I know you're dealing with them as well.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to having this conversation with an expert on the subject. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about diabetes and a drug that lowers the risk of heart complications and kidney disease.
We're going to talk about the bottle size and feeding of infants. Is bigger always better?
About your research about broad support for increasing the legal age of tobacco sales.
And then finally, we're going to talk about if you're a female patient, which I think you are, Christy,
You
happen to go to a male doctor, are they less likely? We know they're maybe less likely to kind of treat you or think about cardiovascular disease, and we'll have some ideas why.
So okay, let's talk
dive
about,
right in.
All right, we'll talk about first a diabetes medication. So we know diabetes is extremely common and comes with it risks, as we've talked about many times, Adam, increased risk for heart disease, for kidney disease, for other effects on the human body. And this is a large clinical trial where they looked at the heart benefits of a diabetes drug called liraglutide, or also known as Victoza or Saxenda, are the trade names, and the outcomes of people who are on this medication with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, this is a study that actually came from the University of North Carolina, originated, and they actually had over 9,000 adults, and half of them were given this new type of drug, which is called a GLP agonist, a fancy name for it helps the pancreas stimulate insulin and reduce the things that kind of raise the blood sugar. And they either got that drug or they got the kind of the standard drugs, and they were, you know, followed them up for 3 years and then looked at how many had had a heart attack or stroke and heart disease deaths or all deaths and even kidney disease. What'd they find?
Well, they found that there were significant benefits. So there was a 13% lower overall risk of having a heart attack, stroke, or of dying from heart disease cause if you were on this medication, a 22% lower risk of just heart mortality, also a lower risk of all-cause mortality, and also a 22% lower risk of new development of advanced kidney disease. So all of this together supports that this medication has a role not just in lowering blood sugar, but also potentially in atherosclerosis, the plaques that form on the heart vessels or the blood vessels in the body, and some other aspects of how it works that then goes on to provide additional benefit towards decreasing the risk of stroke and heart disease.
And before everyone just kind of runs out there and says, I want to take this drug, a couple things to think about.
That's right.
First off, it's expensive. It's over up to $10,000 a year, depending on insurance and what's covered. But it's exceedingly expensive medication. There are some side effects from the drugs, including heart disease or heart speeding up, headaches, some nausea. So it's not, you know, risk-free. And it's also not considered the first-line drug. It's, you know, there are other drugs that are first-line. And it's really if it's not responding to weight loss and diet and some of the other drugs that are really first-line. But it is an option.
Right. It's not the miracle cure. But it is something that if you have type 2 diabetes, is worth talking with your doctor about. Is that medication right for you?
Speaking about talking with your doctor, I think the question is bigger, better when it comes to bottles, baby bottles, and as someone who really still works with a lot of young babies, Christy, what do you think about this next study that was also from the University of North Carolina School of Medicine.
It sure was. This is published in the journal Pediatrics, where really it was an extension of some of the research where we know there are relationships between the container or plate size of food intake for adults and obesity and how many calories people actually take in. And so this research group at UNC wanted to explore whether the same relationship exists in early life with the size of bottles. So this is for families who are either not breastfeeding or who are providing breast milk through a bottle, to look at the size of the bottle at the time of their 2-month well visit and follow that out until their 6-month follow-up visit.
Yeah, they had almost 400 exclusively formula-fed infants. And at the time of their 6-month visit, those who had been fed the formula exclusively from large bottles had gained 7.5 ounces, almost 0.5 pound more than those who were fed with smaller bottles. And I think this begins to give us a little bit of a glimpse that here, bigger is not better, and doesn't tell us why they gained more weight, but perhaps they were pressured to continue to drink more formula. It's hard to know really exactly the mechanisms involved.
Well, and there's implication that this is, of course, then linked to their risk for adolescent and adult obesity. But given the length of follow-up, certainly more study is needed to understand the relationship, if it is direct, between our nutrition and our effort to pack in and chunk up our babies and what happens later in life. But an important topic and really well done.
Well, the next research that matters, Christy,
is amazing. It's so well done.
One of the best that I've ever seen.
The best research. I mean, really.
Some politician that I know.
Life changing. who led this research, Adam Goldstein?
Well, this research, I'm really happy to say, did come from our group, our tobacco group at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, and then our Lineberger Cancer Center. And this was a study that we've been doing for the last couple of years, where we did a survey of over 5,000 adults, a representative sample across the United States, and really looked at different factors relating to people's use of tobacco products, cigarettes, and also their attitudes towards regulation. In this particular case, their attitudes towards raising the minimum legal age of sale of tobacco products, which is 18, except in 2 states in the country where it's 21, Hawaii and California. And do people support actually raising it in different regions of the country?
And what is remarkable is that what you found, you and your team, Adam, is that the majority of adults across the nation in different states and different populations, the majority of people support increasing the minimum legal age for tobacco product sales. And most people support increasing it to 21 instead of just to 20 or 19.
Yeah, we were really, I think, surprised, but also this was really shows to give some direction to policymakers. Our lead author on this was a colleague who's now at East Carolina University, and we found there was majority support in tobacco-producing states. We found it was majority support even among smokers. So it seems like this is one of those things, it's not a Republican or Democrat. It's something that people come together on because they see it protecting youth and young adults from taking up tobacco addiction. A good mm-hmm. thing.
Really well done. Important research, Adam.
Thank you, Christy.
Let's talk finally about male practitioners. So male doctors are more likely to consider, I'll just jump to the point, are more likely to consider heart disease a man's issue.
It's a problem. Well, it's not me, but it'd be all my other male colleagues. No. This was in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology, and they surveyed 52 general practitioners, over 2,000 patients, about the kind of characteristics and what would lead them to do different types of assessments, and basically found that the male doctors were much less likely to record information about smoking, blood sugar, and cholesterol in the charts of the female patients than the male doctors did on the male patients. And if you don't record it, you're probably not assessing the risk factors, which we know are important for women just as they are for men.
They are. If you are a woman or a male patient out there, you should talk with your doctor on a regular basis in your preventive exams about your risk for heart disease and ways that you can reduce your risk over time. Okay, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Eve Wittenberg from the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard School of Public Health about family caregivers. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Eve Wittenberg, Senior Research Scientist at the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard School of Public Health, about family caregivers, a really important topic.
Welcome, Dr. Wittenberg. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, your research is in the area of health decision science. Share with us and our listeners how you became interested in this field as your area of passion, and maybe what is health decision science?
So health decision science is the science of how we make decisions. And of course, in health, it's particularly about how we make decisions in health. And so I actually started out in a related field when I was doing my dissertation research in grad school. And I was working with somebody who was really interested in automobile safety, of all things, and airbags. And he was interested in how parents decide, honestly, where they seat their children in a car, because it's very risky to have your child sitting in the front seat in one of those child seats when an airbag explodes. So I was working with him because that's what you do when you're doing your dissertation in whoever has something for you to work on. And I got really interested in sort of the psychology about how people make decisions and how people choose what they're going to do and how it relates to health. And so we interestingly found that women, the people who we always expect to really be caretakers for their children, were always putting their children in that front seat, or more often, not always. And it was not what we thought, but it was because women wanted to keep an eye. Moms wanted to keep an eye on their kids. So that psychology about how people make those decisions really intrigued me. And then I transitioned into more traditional medical decisions, not auto safety, because that's really what my passion is about, how people decide whether to, you know, take a cancer screening test, you know, get a pap smear, how they decide to quit smoking, what's going on in their mind. So that's really the field of decision science, and that's what got me excited about it, I don't know, 20 years ago now.
Wow. Well, that's exciting, though. I must say, the men, rather than have the child in the front seat or the back seat, happen to leave the child at home by mistake. So don't feel so guilty that we have lots of blame
around. On the top, right, with the coffee cup.
I've heard that story many times.
So let's fast forward to this area. Then, and you just wrote a really important New England Journal of Medicine perspective article about this topic of family caregiving. Tell us how you became interested in this from a background that explores health decisions.
So as we are all getting older, and I'm now in my 50s now, and our parents are getting older, we have older parents, and we start to deal with this caregiving issue. And as my parents have gotten older, I've been struggling and also, you know, enjoying this whole process of taking care of both of my parents, and actually both are have died. But there's a lot of personal anecdote in this actual article. So a lot of it was written out of an experience that I had with my two sisters recently with my mother and taking care of her. So it's just so, it's so concrete and it's so tangible for all of us now with older parents and how we manage to take care of them. But it's also an issue that many of my friends, my close friends with young children, are dealing with all the time, and how they take care of their children's illnesses or disabilities and how that affects, you know, their relationship with their spouse, if they have one, the other children in the house. So it just seems to be everywhere right now. But for me, it really came out of taking care of my parents as they got older.
Now, you talk about in your New England Journal of Medicine article about informal caregivers and where you look at caring at family members from a cost-benefit perspective. share with us some of the costs and some of the benefits, and I'm sure we'll get into a lot of this as we carry on in our conversation, but how do you frame the costs and the benefits of the informal caregivers of a family?
Yeah, so those informal caregivers are us taking care of people at home. You know, they're the people who don't literally get paid for doing it as a quote unquote real job, you know, with a salary. I mean, it's definitely a real job, but the costs are the wages that we lose. So as my mother was going through, you know, getting older and having issues at home and needing care, you know, my sisters and I inevitably took time off from work. And, you know, depending on each of our jobs, going down to less than full time means some lost income. So that's an actual real cost. There's other things just, you know, around the house that are not that salary that's lost, but it's if you are normally, doing all the work around the house, you know, taking care of the children, doing the housework and stuff, and if you instead have to hire people to do that, to do childcare or other things, those are actual real costs, you know, sort of real money that actually gets paid out or is lost by lost wages. The benefits are really immense for the patient as well as oftentimes for the caregivers and also the other family members. So the patient gets care that is oftentimes more trusted, more comfortable, usually is more care than if you hire people to do it, you know, more actual hours of being taken care of. And it's something that's oftentimes much more just comfortable and comforting for patients to be at home. So that's a huge benefit. It's also actually just for society, it's far less expensive. Generally, informal caregivers, meaning us, don't get paid. You know, we don't get paid by anybody to do it. So there's no insurance company paying us. So there's no cost there. While being in a nursing home or being in the hospital, it's hugely expensive. So those are benefits for the patient and they're benefits for society at large. And there's also just benefits for the caregivers and for the family. So for even though it's stressful and it's difficult and it's often debilitating, it's also immensely rewarding oftentimes to take care of a family member at home and to be able to do that.
Sure. Now we're talking with Dr. Eve Wittenberg, a senior research scientist at Harvard School of Public Health, about family caregivers and informal caregivers. And I thought for a second, Dr. Wittenberg, you were talking about my family. I've in the process of taking care and helping take care of and a pleasure to take care of an elderly parent who's about to enter the ninth decade. And I think for a lot of people my age, when the parents move to a different community, perhaps to then have their last years, is when you're dealing with this. It's complex enough when you have all the siblings in the same city as the parents, and it just seems like the word complexity. There's so many different layers here of a new community for a parent and different relationships and a spouse who may not be their actual mother, but maybe even more of a caregiver. Talk about complexity, because I'm sure you experienced it.
It's enormously, obviously, enormously complex, and it's enormously individual. And part of the complexity is that families are dealing with this with so many different variations of the things you just described, you know, different locations, different resources, different styles of making decisions. We're sort of just learning how to negotiate all these different ways of doing things. So part of the, you know, sort of the problem or the challenge is that there are no set ways of doing this. And we're kind of figuring this out as the baby boomers age and our parents are older and people are living longer. So part of the benefit of all of the improvements in healthcare is that people are living into their 90s, and that in itself gets complicated because we don't know. A lot of the sort of frontier of medicine is kind of unknown at this time, and people are living much longer than we thought through health conditions that we, you know, 20 years ago just were not survivable. So it's a very individualized process, and there aren't a whole lot of standards, and there's a lot of just personal preference and opinion that goes on the provider side as well as on the family side, you know, doctors and other clinicians who, you know, may want more family involvement or might be resistant or uncomfortable with it. It's just so many different aspects.
So many different facets of this complicated web of caring for families and thinking through all the different aspects of how that impacts the patient and their families. What a fascinating conversation. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Eve Wittenberg, Senior Research Scientist at the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard School of Public Health, about family caregivers. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Eve Wittenberg, Senior Research Scientist at the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard School of Public Health, about family caregivers. And before the break, Dr. Wittenberg, you were sharing some aspects of your recent article about informal caregivers that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And you describe in your article a sort of positive feedback loop, wherein giving care can sometimes make the caregiver's health deteriorate, which then leads to more people in the healthcare system as they need their own health care. How can we as a system and as a group of medical professionals intervene to try to impact that, to take care of our families in ways that create a more positive feedback loop?
So I think the most important thing, and what we found from actual research in this area, is that caregivers, their burden would be less if they were more involved in the process. So some of the difficulty is just sort of trying to navigate the process. So having caregivers' names in medical records, giving them some training in how to do all the stuff that caregiving entails, and giving them the support, literal support, meaning the equipment, the supplies, the phone numbers, that would go a long way to reducing that burden.
You know, it's This whole element of having more people involved, particularly as parents and friends, and we all age, and to recognize the team that gets larger. So even if you're in a continuing care community or an assisted living center, the informal caregiver is still involved. And matter of fact, isn't there some data that the more they're involved, perhaps the better the quality of care? Do we know anything about quality of care in informal caregivers?
You know, we know a little bit less about those actual outcomes. We know that the patients are pleased with being taken care of by families. It's inevitable that you get more attention from someone who's in your family, especially if that's the person who's taking care of you, because it's the sibling, the child who you're usually closer to, and you know, it's the other daughter or son who's farther away who isn't there. So that is usually kind of the way people select into the caregiving. We don't know as much about the actual quality of care. That's a really hard thing to measure.
I also wonder about what models you've learned that have been effective to teach caregivers, you were saying, develop skills and teach families, but also to engage them in the process. We have a program in our own department, the REACH program, that goes out into the homes and provides interdisciplinary care in the homes. There's hospice for end-of-life care. But what have you learned or what models have been effective to really engage those informal caregivers in ways that promote people staying at home and receiving the best care?
So, you know, the biggest and most established model is the hospice model, which has been around for a long time and is well proven in how effective it is, because it really includes the family. It includes the family in planning. It provides these sorts of things I just mentioned, you know, all the equipment at home, the actual staff who come into the home to help out with what's actually going on with the patient. A lot of the other models are a lot of small individual efforts that are only now beginning to be evaluated. And we don't have a real consensus on what works everywhere. And it's part of what we talked about earlier about it being so complex and so different for every family and every situation.
And do you see other places, is there outside of the hospice in the U.S., do we have a model in other countries? Because it seems like we are at a time and place where cutting down on the cost of care, at the same time we're trying to improve quality and the experience, is a major focus. And yet if we're really talking about now expanding the workforce potentially, either symbolically or real, by an order of magnitude, this family caregivers, we've got to figure out how to do that.
It's interesting. You know, in other countries, there are different, I'd call them kind of cultural standards or norms about how families operate. And so some of this is different here in the U.S., you know, not better or worse. And of course, you know, we're such a diverse and heterogeneous country that there's a lot of differences. You know, I'm talking very generally, there's a lot of difference in this country. But in some of the European countries, the culture is that, you know, extended families live together more. Mm-hmm. And there's more norms about older people staying in the same house throughout their lives. And then this takes on a whole different flavor, because if the older people are living there with the other generations, well, it's just kind of natural for this caregiving and interrelationship of the family to go on. So some of this really just varies by culture, and that's a little bit of what we see, at least in some of the European countries, in their research.
Well, it's so intertwined in the family dynamics. In my own family, my mother, very much as she ages, she does not want to be a burden to us. So, you know, I know that I'll be the one who will help take care of her as she ages, but at the same time, it's so important for her that we have our independent family and are not burdened by her. So all of those family dynamics of what may be a privilege to give back to your family members, but also does come at a cost, as you highlight, mixed in with those family expectation and cultural norms in America of, you know, having your own independent family, it is, again, very complicated.
Yeah, and just to note that what you say about burden, I mean, this is huge. And we've been talking mainly about older people, but remember, you know, there are many, many spouses who are taking care of spouses, both of whom may be elderly, and also parents who are taking care of children who are going through, you know, spells of illness or long-term illness. But that burden issue is very, very big. And so the relationship between the caregivers and the patient is very important. And usually when that is a tight and a warm relationship, both benefit. You know, so the patient benefits more when there's no feelings of burden, no feelings of resentment, even though this is a hard thing to do. And the caregiver health is usually better when the patient is feeling comfortable and there's that sort of reciprocity between the two.
How do you recommend, so for instance, I have siblings all around the country who don't live here, and yet their mother they're incredibly close to, and I'm sure we see this repeated in many, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of times. How do you recommend that those caregivers establish and utilize perhaps technology or other forms to really ensure the health of those who are, like, directly providing that care, but that those who can be emotionally supportive? Do you have any tips?
Yeah, so those, and it's good you mentioned that, because we've been always focusing on the caregiver, and what we know from research is those people far away who are connected by, you know, by telephone and other means are also affected, and it's a different kind of effect, but it's very much, very much the case. So that involvement can apply to people whether they're physically there and not, that involvement in the decision-making. You know, now the way medicine is delivered, those decisions can be made by people who aren't really sitting there. It's not the person who has to be in the room. They can be involved in the medical decision-making with the physician through telephone consultations, through connections with social workers. I mean, that stuff can still go on. So establishing those networks, whether or not they're actually physically there, really is the same.
And where would you recommend families get tips or further ideas of ways to engage as a family unit as they're providing this informal care for their loved ones? Are there key websites or resources for people?
Yeah, there are caregiver resources, and a lot of that is directed towards some just the things we've been talking about, many of which are kind of obvious. But when you're in this situation, of course, you know, you forget them completely.
Mm-hmm.
The National Caregivers Alliance has just tips on remembering things about, you know, keeping track of decisions, sharing them, you know, with others who are involved in the family, you know, other children, other siblings,
and we'll
making
put,
sure to take care of, you know, one's own health, kind of the obvious things.
And we'll put that link on to our website. If you could leave our listeners with one final tip of things we discussed today, what would it be?
So it sounds obvious, but it's really that everybody benefits when we think about health as a family consideration, a family concern. When we talk about the patient and the people around them, everything goes back and forth. The patients are better, the other people are better, and it's not just the caregivers, it's everybody involved in the family.
That is so true. As you're speaking to two family doctors, we believe it fully. Thank you for your time. We've been talking with Dr. Eve Wittenberg, who is from the Center for Health Decision Science at Harvard School of Public Health, about family caregivers and ways that we can all care for one another.
Thank you, Dr. Wittenberg.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question, please.
I'm a 60-year-old overweight man with some heart problems, and I really want to exercise, but I'm so out of shape. Should I see a cardiologist, a physical therapist, or just my local doctor?
Wow. Well, congratulations to you for having that desire and really wanting to exercise and even being at the point where you're thinking about, okay, how do I get started?
And I've got the answer here, Christy.
Great. What is it?
Yes, yes, yes. In some circumstances. And that's the long answer. The shorter answer is
just
maybe,
yes.
Well, go to a cardiac rehab. This is a good example of someone who really could benefit, I think, from a cardiac rehab program. We don't think of it so often. You know, someone who's maybe got some risk factors and has some heart disease and really needs to exercise and might need to see three different doctors to kind of get it all going, but maybe they could qualify and get a cardiac rehab and have all these things in one place.
Right.
It's just a thought.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. And it also depends on, you say, with some heart problems, what those heart problems are and what, I mean, there's a lot of factors here, but I would definitely pursue talking with your doctor. And if you already have a cardiologist for your heart problems and having that conversation too. There are lots of resources here to help you get started.
Daniel, what's our very next house call?
I've had a small rash on the back of my head for a few months now. It doesn't itch, but it's flaky and red and doesn't appear to be going away on its own. Should I see a doctor?
It would be unlikely people think about fungus, but fungus infection of the scalp probably doesn't happen nearly as much. And, you know, it depends if those scales kind of come out. Depending on someone's age, if they're older and it's kind of scaly, you would worry that, you know, make sure it's not like a skin cancer because it doesn't itch, and skin cancers don't itch and they don't have any symptoms necessarily. So it seems pretty straightforward. And even some hydrocortisone cream, sometimes with a little bit of itching, you can, you know, but this doesn't itch. It does puzzle me just a little bit here. I'm puzzled. I'd love to see a picture.
Yeah, send us a picture, but also take it to your doctor and show them in person to take a look. Sometimes on your head, it's also hard to see really well and notice if it's
changing.
Can't
take that iPhone and just kind of get it back
really
there
tricky,
and get another mirror in front of you and kind of get that. No, won't work.
No, but it's good that you're paying attention to it and that you get follow-up. Thanks for the question.
Daniel, what's our very next house call?
My brother is a pretty heavy drinker, and myself and some other members of my family are starting to worry about him. We want to get him all the resources he can to cut back on his drinking, but are there any resources we can get from his doctor?
Well, this is a tough and a really important issue. So thank you, first off, for sharing it and raising it so we can talk about it.
And I would say, yes, the answer to your question, yes, your doctor can have some community resources and resources to help him cut back or quit on his drinking. But the question, as I read this, is and hear your question, is wondering, does he want to back up off on his drinking, or does he see the risks involved in this? So this may be also a conversation with your family and really talking with him about your concerns, sharing openly some of those risks, and then making a plan to move forward.
You know, sometimes hearing it from you as a family member is impactful, but it can be even more impactful if the doctor really takes this seriously. And so sometimes I find ways to hopefully encourage open communication from family members, maybe ask, can you communicate and talk with your brother's doctor? Ask your brother if you can do that. Ask if you can come into the session. And then once you can raise the issue and the doctor can be really aware of it, the doctor might be able to refer to a therapist, might be able to encourage him to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, might be able to give him medication. There are medications that can actually reduce the amount he drinks.
Yep.
All options.
Mm-hmm. And very, very helpful if he's willing for you to come with him to that, to an appointment with a doctor. It really does make a difference. I can think of multiple instances where that mattered in my care of a patient, to have a family member come in and say, hey, he's drinking a lot. He hadn't told you about it, but he gave me permission to tell you. It really can help sometimes open that conversation in a new way with a physician.
A child at my daughter's daycare has developed pertussis, and we got a note from the daycare saying we should be careful over the next few days and maybe consider keeping our kids at home for a bit. My daughter got her vaccine for whooping cough, so is there anything we need to worry about?
Well, boy, I bet this is panic city. I bet all of the parents in the hotline. I would actually get a communication person on for that school, and hopefully they're really maybe a doctor advisor that can really get that information out, because this is scary.
Yeah, and it depends on, I mean, you haven't mentioned the age of your child or your children, so it's hard to have a sense of that. But it sounds like, you know, making sure that you bring, I would bring the daughter to your doctor and just say, hey, is there any medication that's indicated for if she had really close contact with this child who was actively coughing or with saliva or other things, and that age that they're sharing that closely, then it may be that an antibiotic is warranted. And also to review immunizations for your family. Now we're doing a lot more boosters in terms of giving boosters to children, but also in every pregnancy, making sure you get your Tdap and that your spouse gets his Tdap before you have a newborn. So there are a lot of complexities to think about.
Yeah, and certainly, even though your child may have had their shot, that doesn't mean they wouldn't still get antibiotics, particularly if they've had this close contact, which is defined as 3 feet face-to-face with someone who is really symptomatic, and this could be someone who also has contact with the respiratory or the nasal or the oral secretions. So if the child's been coughing and the child's really been playing together versus it was in the same school but not in the same classroom, that probably won't qualify. Great question. Important topic. We'll ask our health science librarians to put up some information about what we call post-exposure treatment for people who've been close face-to-face contact.
Great idea. Well, thank you for your house call questions today and for all of you for joining us for your health. We hope that we've been able to address some issues and concerns that are important to you. And we want you to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us on yourhealthradio.org, on Twitter, Facebook, or get our health app through iTunes.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Eve Wittenberg. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. Look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.